Okay. Good morning, everyone. Good morning. So welcome back. And we are going to start have a look at some of the suttas for this retreat. Has everyone got a copy of the suttas? Yeah? Everyone all right? Okay, good. So you don't really have to look too much on the page because I'm going to read it out and explain as we go along. So just, do whatever you... whatever works, as they say here. So we're going to start off by looking at a sutta called the Maha Parinibbana Sutta. Have you heard about that sutta before? Any one of you? No, you haven't? Okay, some of you have? Okay, good. And this is, in many ways, one of the most famous suttas of all the Buddha's discourses for many reasons. One of the main reasons is because this is like the last journey of the Buddha. It is when he kind of walks towards his final destination, where he passes away, and this kind of all the things that happen on the last journey. And you can imagine that's quite interesting, yeah, because the Buddha is laying down what are you going to do after I die, right? How are you going to live after I die? It's going to be pretty rough for everyone. So he kind of lays on this journey, he tells them how to survive, tells the Buddhist community how to survive, how to think about the Buddha's teachings, who is going to be their leader after the Buddha passes away. And so he sets the scene like for future generations. And we are future generations, that's us. So he sets the scene for us. And that's what is kind of interesting about this. So for this reason, he lays down things that are very relevant for our practice, and that's why I think it's useful to start with that, and then we can kind of move on to some more detailed suttas about practice and those sort of things afterwards. So this is the sutta, and this sutta, this is only a tiny fraction of a very long sutta, and in many ways it's not really a sutta in the ordinary sense. Because a sutta really is like a particular teaching of the Buddha. Yeah, the Buddha stays in a certain place, the people come out, and the Buddha gives everyone a teaching. But this here is more like a narrative, it's more like a story. And there's a little teachings in between as part of this story. So it's a bit different. And this, I suppose, is part of what makes it interesting and exciting. So the very beginning of this story, the Buddha is staying at Rajagaha. Rajagaha is the capital of the ancient Indian empire of Magadha. Have anyone here been to India before? One over there? Okay, cool. Yeah, okay, two. Okay, excellent. That's cool. That's great. Did you go to the Buddhist holy sites when you were there? Okay, excellent. Yeah, I've been there a number of times myself, and I have to admit I have a love-hate relationship to India, but... And there's many aspects that are really wonderful, but there are some aspects when you come from a Western culture that are quite difficult to deal with as well. So it's kind of this double-edged sword. But India has a very beautiful spiritual history, right? And even today you go to India, people are very spiritual by nature, very interested in the idea of a spiritual life. So it's no wonder when I was there, I could understand why the Buddha would be born in India, not somewhere else, not in Norway. That's where I come from. Norway, Norway's like a spiritual desert, and it's icy cold anyway. It's just so I can sort of see that. So that kind of made sense. So for that reason, just coming to the place where the Buddha was, sitting in the places where the Buddha was sitting, it's like electric, right? The Buddha sat here. It's like, whoa, okay, can I deal with this? Okay, you can deal with it. So you do it. There's something very powerful about that. And you may think that how can we actually know where the Buddha was? And we can, because many of these geographical places, they are described in the suttas. Yeah, the vulture peak looks a bit like a vulture. Rajagaha, this city, which later on becomes the capital of the Magadhan Empire. They have very distinct geographical kind of features to it. It is like in the middle of the hills. It's called the Giribhaja, which means the hill fort. And when you're there, you can see why it is a hill fort, because it is kind of surrounded by hills. And so you recognize these places. So it's like you're entering the suttas when you go there. That's kind of cool, isn't it? You see the sutras, you think these are just ancient stories, right? No, they are real. These are actually things that happened 2,500 years ago. This is what becomes very clear to you when you go there. Yeah. And of course, India is this kind of timeless realm. Yeah, there's something about India. Nothing has changed in 2,500 years in India. It's like you go there and you have this feeling of timelessness in many ways. Of course, that's a deception because it isn't completely timeless, but there are aspects to India that seem to be carrying on for very, very long periods of time. This is where the Buddha starts out on this last journey, the capital city of Magadha, and then he travels north and he does many stops on the way. And eventually he comes to one of the other famous places, which is called Vesali, which was the capital of what is called the Vajrayana Republic. Yeah, there were republics in those days. They had they had democracy. Yeah, they had, it wasn't like a democracy like now, but there were certain kind of the prominent people, yeah, and usually it was men. They had kind of a vote, and then they, you know, a bit like Athens, ancient Greece, a similar kind of thing. Yeah. And this existed in India 2,500 years ago. That's about the same time as the ancient Greeks. So where did democracy start, in Greece or in India? Now there is a question for you right there. And I think the reality is that many of these institutions that we have in our societies, they didn't really originate in one particular place. Yeah, I mean, it's very convenient for us. We are kind of, you know, when you are belong to that kind of historical cultural tradition, you think, yeah, it started in Greece. Yeah, and that's kind of cool if you are European or whatever. But actually, it isn't like that. These things are ideas that have existed among humanity going back, I think, to, you can go back as far as you like, and they probably have existed in some way or another. And this idea that things kind of have an origination point, and that we are always making progress, always heading in the right direction or whatever, actually it's more like a kind of, up and down kind of thing, like a yo-yo kind of thing, and not so, it's not like a linear progress as we sometimes think of our societies. So these things were already there at that particular time. Anyway, I'm not going to get too much into that. And so the Buddha goes there, and this is really where we are picking up on the story. Yeah, the Buddha's passing through these places, coming to Vesali, staying there for the rains retreat. And now we're going to see what happens at Vesali during the rains retreat. Are you ready for this? Yeah? Okay, good. Okay. This is one of the requisites of a forest monk, your laptop. It's a bit embarrassing, I have to admit, but anyway, there it is. So he is staying here in Vesali for the rainy season. Yeah, monastics go for retreat for 3 months during the rainy season. And this is what happens then. So after the Buddha had commenced the rainy season residence, he fell severely ill, struck by dreadful pains, close to death. But he endured unperturbed with mindfulness and situational awareness. Then it occurred to the Buddha, it would not be appropriate for me to become fully extinguished before informing my attendants and taking leave of the mendicant Sangha. Why don't I forcefully suppress this illness, stabilize the life force, and live on? So that's what he did. Then the Buddha's illness died down. Here, one of the nice things about this little passage is that it kind of brings out the humanity of the Buddha. Yeah, he is like a human being. He becomes severely ill, close, dreadful pains. You can imagine 2,500 years ago, it was difficult to come by, morphine and these kind of things. Yeah, they didn't really have, it was hard, palliative care didn't really exist, and probably did actually, but not quite in the way we have it now. So you had to deal with things. You really had to kind of deal with these pains in a very different way. This kind of humanizes the Buddha when you see this. And I think this is one of the very important things in Buddhism. In traditional Buddhism, if you look at the history of the way the Buddha is talked about in traditional Buddhism, the Buddha kind of becomes more and more elevated and more distant from ordinary human beings. And after a while you wonder, is he a god? Is he kind of the ultimate force of the universe? Is he the kind of the kind of some sort of weird thing, the Dhammakaya or whatever it is? Or was the Buddha human? And one of the things that you find throughout the suttas is that the Buddha was a human being. I was going to say just like, maybe not just like us, but very close, right? I mean, obviously he had some special wisdom because, you know, without that wisdom, he wouldn't be able to make this breakthrough. But potentially that wisdom is available to all of us. So there's no fundamental difference between the Buddha and us as human beings. And this is a very important thing to kind of get our heads around, especially, I think, for most people who have grown up in the kind of Western context outside of a traditional Buddhist context. It is not that difficult to see, but I know for many people who have grown up in a Buddhist society and have been fed on the stories of the Buddha, it is quite hard to kind of get out of that mindset that the Buddha is something otherworldly or something beyond ordinary human beings. And this is not the result of the suttas, the word of the Buddha, but that is the result of the later mythologizing and making a legend out of the Buddha, when really, from the suttas, it's quite clear that he was a human being. And so this kind of makes you feel sympathy with the Buddha. Yeah, he's kind of really ill. And he probably can deal with it, right? He's the Buddha after all. But still, it kind of makes you almost, you feel, okay, I want to look after the Buddha. Yeah, you want to go out and help him or whatever. Kind of compassion arises for him when you see these things. And then that's like having the right attitude. You can imagine people like Venerable Ananda, who was his attendant, he would really look after the Buddha, make sure that he was okay and he got the kind of food that he needed. And Ananda was often like the guard. I was going to say guard dog. I'm not sure if it's nice to call Ananda a dog. So he was like, but he was the guardian. He would make sure people didn't come and bother the Buddha when he was sick and these kind of things. So they really look after him. So the Buddha was human. And when we understand that the Buddha was human, then when you hear the Buddha teach, you hear the Buddha give kind of autobiographical teachings, talking about how he overcame the problems, then you know that those autobiographical teachings were given not because the Buddha was talking about himself, but he wanted to inspire us, right? This is what I did. You should do the same. I am human. You are human. So the same path applies to both of us. So this becomes then very, very interesting and very inspiring. We understand the Buddha in the right way. So the Buddha is human, but he is someone who takes the human potential to the highest level. And that is what makes the Buddha interesting. So I would really recommend you, if you come in here and you feel like bowing down to the Buddha statue, I don't know how used you are to that, if you find that awkward or whatever, please try it out. It's a beautiful thing to do, to bow down to, because what you're bowing down to is not a statue. A statue just represents something else, right? What you're bowing down to is something, a potential in human being, a potential for kindness, a potential for compassion, a potential for wisdom, for understanding the world as it actually is. You're bowing down to something really worthwhile bowing down to, And these are qualities that exist potentially within each one of us. It's almost like you're bowing down to your own potential, in a sense. So it's not as if we are kind of, this is not about a hierarchy or anything like that. It's about building up good qualities within ourselves. And when you bow down to something that is really powerful, it means you respect these things. That's what it means. It doesn't mean that you are kind of humbling yourself in a bad way. Well, it's good to be a bit humble anyway, but it is a way of respecting something. So please try to bow down. Even if it is awkward in the beginning, you get used to it surprisingly quickly, I can tell you. And once you're used to it, it feels really natural and it actually feels very beautiful. So try it out. So I'm gonna kind of aid you a little bit in that afterwards. I'm going to tell you, okay, I'm going to bow now, so please follow along. Is that okay? okay, great. We'll see how that happens. We'll see what happens. So the Buddha is this potential that we're all kind of striving towards, heading towards. And here we are seeing the humanity of the Buddha in much as we can see our own humanity. But of course, he does have some higher powers, so he's able to endure these things unperturbed. Yeah, with mindfulness and situational awareness, sati sampajanya in the Pali. Situational awareness just means that whatever situation you're in, you know what is appropriate in that situation. That's really what it means. Yeah, so he understands, okay, I'm sick, I'm going to be mindful, and I'm going to kind of be able to deal with that somehow. That's really what he's thinking here. And in Buddhism, we have this idea of the two darts. Yeah, the two darts is the dart of the body, so you have pain through the body, and there's the dart of the mind. Yeah, and the dart of the mind is like the extra pain that you develop by proliferating or thinking about the pain of the body, by having craving that this should cease. Oh no, this pain is terrible. And you think about it, you proliferate about it, you can't get your mind off it, and you crave the ending of this pain, and you make it 20,000, I'm not sure if that's a very accurate number, but anyway, a lot worse than it has to be, right? And this is how often it is. So in Buddhism, it's possible to separate these two darts. So you can have the dart of the body, feel pain in the body, but avoid the dart of the mind. You don't make it worse than it actually is. So this is what is going on here with the Buddha. So, and then he says, that he should not become fully extinguished. This is nibbana, is extinguishment. Before informing my attendants, which is Venerable Ananda, and taking leave of the mendicant sangha. Mendicant Sangha, this is the Bhikkhu Sangha. Mendicant is an old English word which means that you rely on alms. This translation is done by a monk called Bhantasujato. Have you heard about Bhantasujato? Yeah, some of you have? Okay, yeah. So those who are really into the suttas, you will know Bhantasujato. He's one of the most prolific translators, and he runs this whole, one of the most well-known websites for Buddhist suttas in the world, probably. Maybe the number one go-to website for Buddhist suttas. So that's kind of his translation, mendicant. And it's very accurate. It's a bit old-fashioned. I don't know if mendicant, but, it's... It's accurate. That's the nice thing about it. One of the things that I should let you know is that the word sangha in Buddhism always refers to the monastics. Yeah, I know that here in the United States, sangha is more like a group of practitioners. Yeah, so coming together, but actually in the suttas, it always refers to the monastics. So it's useful to remember that, because sometimes we don't use the words in exactly the same way they were used at the time of the Buddha. So that, I think, is a significant point. Forcefully suppress this illness. Yeah, so there is an ability there to deal with the illness forcefully. I'm not sure if I like that translation. It's more like using your... will to some extent, using the volition, intentionally suppressing it perhaps, stabilizing the life force, in other words, you can say the will to live, having the will to live, not giving up on the will to live, and then live on, and that's what he does, and so then he carries on. This kind of brings up the interesting question, if the Buddha did not do this, if he decided, maybe it's time to die or whatever, to what extent does the Buddha decide his point of death? And if he decides his point of death, is he committing suicide? He's saying, okay, enough now, I'm going to end all of this. Did the Buddha commit suicide? Is that possible at the end of his life? And it sounds a bit weird, doesn't it? But it's kind of, if you are a Buddha, we know how ordinary people are very much, when the moment you die, very often depends on all kind of things, mental things, right? Are you, if you're very common, you see in the world, if people live in a partnership, maybe husband or wife or whatever, and one of them dies and the other one dies soon afterwards because you lose your will to live. Your partner over a long, long time is dying, and it's very hard to carry on. And so obviously there is a mental aspect to this idea of dying. So to what extent does the Buddha apply that? You can imagine the Buddha has ability to apply this far more than ordinary people. So does the Buddha decide these things? Does the Buddha commit suicide? Does it die a natural death? There's kind of many different ideas here, potential ideas behind this. When we read the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, there's many ideas clashing with each other. It's not entirely clear what is happening here. But my proclivity is always to read things as natural as possible, yeah? And we see here he's getting old, he's dying, you know, and things are going the wrong direction. So a very large part of it, obviously, is just old age, yeah? You die of old age because the body is wearing out. Anyway, let's move on a little bit. Soon after the Buddha had recovered from that sickness, he came out from his dwelling and sat in the shade of the porch on the seat spread out. Then Venerable Ananda went up to the Buddha, bowed, sat down to one side, and said to him, "Sir, it is fantastic that the Buddha is comfortable and well, because when the Buddha was sick, my body felt like it was drugged. I was disoriented and the teachings weren't clear to me. Still, at least I was consoled by the thought that the Buddha won't become fully extinguished without making some statement regarding the Sangha of mendicants." So here we have the Venerable Ananda, yeah, the Buddha's main attendant, saying that this was very upsetting for him that the Buddha was ill, because he knew that the Buddha may have been on his deathbed, yeah, may have been the very end of his life. Really disconcerted, teachings don't become clear. And this is what happens when your mind gets confused. Yeah, you forget about the Dhamma. You forget what you should be doing. Yeah? We become really stupid when we get confused, etc. And this is what's happening here to Venerable Ananda. And you can imagine, this is a very strong and powerful time in the Buddha's history, when the Buddha is about to pass away. Yeah. Here is this person who has been holding together the Sangha, holding together the teachings. The person who is the go-to person whenever there's a problem in the Sangha. And it's kind of fascinating when you read, especially when you read the Vinaya Pitaka. The Vinaya Pitaka are all the rules of the monastics and all the kind of procedures that the monastic use to make decisions and all of this. Vinaya Pitaka is actually a very interesting document. And in there, whenever the monastics kind of have a question, yeah, kind of tiny little questions, is this allowable, is that allowable, you know, can I eat? What if there's a little bit of, you know, sugar is allowable in the afternoon for monks, but what if there's a tiny bit of contamination to the sugar, yeah, what should we do? And they go to the Buddha, please, Master, you know, explain to us if this is okay or not. And the tiniest little thing, they'll go to the Buddha. And after a while, you start to feel a bit sorry for the Buddha, yeah, I have to ask all of these things. You know what it's like, yeah? Okay, figure it out yourself, right? This is not rocket science, yeah? This is... and you can feel sorry for some of the senior teachers sometimes. So very important, yeah? And you can imagine how inspiring it is to be around the Buddha. Yeah, I mean, if you look at how the Buddha is described in the suttas, no defilements, no anger, no desires, clarity of the mind at all times... And it may not sound all that inspiring never to be angry, but, you know, the converse is true. Because you have no anger, you're always compassionate. You're always seeing the good things in people. You're always encouraging. There's all these positive qualities that come out when the negative qualities are abandoned. So the Buddha, and it's always peaceful, right? I don't know if you have met some of these people in your life. But I have, being a monk, this is one of the great things about being a monk, right? You get to meet some really remarkable people. This is much more difficult if you are a lay person. So I'm here also to market the monastic life. This is part of what I'm here for. And people don't really understand sometimes all the advantages of being a monastic. There's heaps of advantages. You have to be ready. You have to want to do it. But if you feel you are inclining that direction, there's some very, very powerful things about monastic life, whether it is as a nun or a monk, a bhikkhuni or a bhikkhu. And one of them is you meet some amazing people. And there are some people in this world, you look at them and think, wow, is that possible? How can you always be so energetic, always so mindful, always so bright? No one is like that. Yeah, people who are always happy. How can you always be happy? Don't be happy. I'm fed up with your happiness. Yeah. Oh, yeah. After a while. You know what it's like sometimes. And I have met some of these people. It's like bright all the time. Always bright. Always happy. Always peaceful. And I think, and then they can see, and this monk I know, maybe I can say later on who some of these people are, but And then towards the end of a long day, I've been talking to people all the time. Okay, oh, I'm feeling a little bit tired now. I'm just going back to my QT for a while. Goes back to his QT. I don't know what he does in his QT, but he recharges, comes out, bang. He's like superpower again, right? And that's kind of, when you see that, it's kind of extraordinary because people in the world just aren't like that. And the Buddha, of course, is like that, except 1,000 times more, right? He goes back, does some meditation, from very profound meditation, comes out and has all these superpowers again. So it's a very traumatic time for the Sangha when someone like that is about to pass away. It's really, really hard to deal with, right? I just think of myself, if Ajahn Brahm was to die, Ajahn Brahm is my teacher, in case you, I mentioned that yesterday. If Ajahn Brahm is going to die, it's going to be bad for me, right? Not least because I have to take over all those jobs that he's doing, that's kind of part of it, but mostly because he's a very inspiring teacher. And sometimes you rely, it's very helpful to be inspired by other people. And sometimes I just sit in the Dhamma hall, Ajahn Brahm gives a Dhamma talk once a week, and I just sit there, I just absorb the vibe. I don't listen to what he says, because he says the same thing every time. No, I'm being very naughty. Don't tell Ajahn Brahm I said that. But, you know, he talks quite differently to the monks than he does to lay people. So what you see on YouTube is one thing. What he says in the monastery is a bit different. But, you know, after having given 10,000 talks, or how many it is, it's difficult to renew yourself all that much. So you've heard it all before. But that is not the main point. The main point is the feeling, the vibe, the juju. I've learned this word after coming to the US. Apparently those over a certain age, they don't understand the word juju, but apparently it means something like vibe. So the vibe is really good. And that is very tangible. You sit in the presence of Ajahn Brahm and you feel peaceful. And you can't avoid it, right? And that's kind of, it's like a osmosis, it's like a transmission, it's like a feeling in the room. And it just kind of permeates you after a while, and you don't have any choice in the matter but feeling these things. If that is true for someone like Ajahn Brahm, imagine with the Buddha, You just hang around, you want to hang around the Buddha all the time, you don't want to leave his presence because you feel so good in the presence of someone like that. So that is what is happening here. And of course, even Venerable Ananda, who's supposed to be a stream mentor at this point, he's already seen the teachings, he knows what is going on, even he has this reaction. It's a very traumatic time for the Sangha. And of course, they are, please say something before you pass away, pass something on, right? We want to know what is the kind of final word of the Buddha that's going to kind of help us all to carry on into the future. And of course, we are going to get to the final word of the Buddha later on, and I will tell you what that is. And it's a very interesting what he has to say at the very end. Some of you probably know this already, but I'm going to repeat it for effect. So the Ananda says, you're going to make a statement in regarding to the Sangha. So we're going to see in a second what the Buddha has to say about this. But according to my schedule, I have made a schedule which is with a little bit more breaks than usual, so I don't kind of go on kind of droning on for too long, because I know after a while you can't absorb anything more anyway. So I just have this half an hour sutta sessions with small meditation breaks to make this kind of thing sink in a little bit. And then I give you a chance to kind of ask some questions and things as we go along to keep it a bit more kind of alive in a sense. So I was going to suggest now we have 5-minute meditation break. Is that make sense? So let's do that. And this is also an opportunity, if you need to stretch your legs or you need a toilet break or whatever, please take this opportunity here. Okay, maybe we should stop there. Sorry about that. It's just a bit of a cold which is lingering a little bit. Just short little breaks. Does anyone have any questions at this point you would like to bring up while it is still fresh in your mind, these things? Yes, please.
Is there a concept of lineage in India at that time, spiritual lineage? So what would the mendicants have been expecting from the Buddha as a statement?
Yeah, that's a spiritual lineage at that time. It was the main spiritual lineage was like the Brahmanical tradition, the Brahmins, who later on became the Hinduism of India. And they had a very clear lineage in the sense that they had their texts, which were the Vedas, and they were memorized and passed on from one generation to the next one. But it was more like a general kind of, I don't know how hierarchical it was, but it was as general, all Brahmins were supposed to learn these texts, and there was a lineage in that sense. And the rest of the society, the Vedas were kept secret from the rest of the society because that gave power to the Brahmins. That's how they could charge money, because they knew the kind of the secret doctrines and the verses that you're supposed to chant at the funeral, all these kind of things. So that's kind of what's kept within that fold, so to speak. In the other tradition, were there lineages? There seemed to have been in certain traditions. The Jains, for example, they had the Mahavira, who was the leader of the Jains at this particular time. And he apparently was not the first leader. They had leaders prior to that. So they seemed to have a kind of leadership succession, which is like a lineage, I suppose, same kind of idea. So there seems to have been a bit of variety of ways of doing things, not kind of one clear way. But what is interesting, we shall see in the second, in Buddhism, there's no concept of lineage. And this is kind of fascinating because today, in the Buddhist world today, there's all these ideas of lineage everywhere, right? But that is not the way the Buddha taught these things at all. This is why I find it so important to go back to the word of the Buddha. Because when you go back to the word of the Buddha, then you kind of are actually approaching the way that the Buddha wanted us to deal with Buddhism. Go back to the earliest teaching. Go back to how the Buddha taught, and that is your teacher. That is your lineage. The Buddha is really what it is about. And that doesn't mean we should not have contemporary teachers. Of course we should have contemporary teachers. Otherwise I shouldn't be here, right? Otherwise I would really... So we should, but we should go back to the word of the Buddha as the gold standard, as the thing which kind of frames and everything else. And there's something very beautiful about that, because there's something very dangerous, I think, about having lineages and gurus and these kind of things, because that is where abuse starts to happen, yeah? There's a lot of abuse in spiritual circles in the world. I mean, the majority, of course, is not abuse, but there is still a lot of abuse going on. And the more power there is, the more kind of power dynamic there is with the gurus and this kind of thing, the more chances of abuse. Yeah. So that everyone kind of bows down to the same Buddha, it flattens the field a little bit. It makes it less hierarchical, right? So if we bow together to the Buddha, that's kind of a nice thing here. And it shows that we all take in the same person as our teacher. So we'll come to that in a second. We'll see more about that. Anyone else want to ask anything? Yes, a couple of people. Yeah, please.
If I remember correctly, Jesus' Sutta, I guess, precedes where Buddha knowingly takes some cooking from someone who was ill and knew that he was kind of ill. Is that not correct?
Sorry, can you say the Buddha took some
Yeah. He went to get a meal that was prepared by someone who he knew was going to make him ill, and then he became ill. Is that not correct?
Right, yeah, exactly. That is what I meant by the stories of how the Buddha passed away are a little bit contradictory, and that is the last meal of the Buddha, and that kind of comes later on in the same sutta. I wasn't really going to talk about it, but now that you bring it up, yes, that is the thing, and it... But whether the Buddha knew that it was going to make him ill or not, I think that is a bit up for debate. I mean, I don't know how you would know that. That is the story, that he took this meal, it made him ill. And that is one of the ways that the Buddha passed away. This is a kind of one of the... So what exactly did he die from? Did he die from that meal? Well, it looks like it. But then the sutta says, well, he also died by giving up the life faculty. That's another way. And then he dies, his old age, his body is falling apart. What did he actually die from, right? So all of these things kind of come together somehow. And maybe there is a way of unifying this. I don't know. But this kind of seems to be kind of different storylines, slightly diverging and not entirely clear what is happening here. But it doesn't matter. The point is that Buddha is a human being. If he gets the wrong food... Just like us, he dies. He has old age, he dies from that, etc., etc. So I think that's the main issue here. Please, at the back there. What? Someone wanted to ask something at the back?
That was my question.
That was your question, was it? Okay, same question. Okay, great. So I'm glad we got that clarified. Anyone else want to say anything? Yes, please.
It is as powerful as what we're reading.
Well, it's just one of those things. I mean, this is one of the things I contemplate. I'm asked all the time why I'm a Buddhist monk. Yeah, you should be skiing in Norway. That was your heritage, right? You should be a Viking or whatever. And the answer is, I decided to give a talk on this called Why I'm a Buddhist Monk. So there's a talk on that. There's a booklet on that as well, actually, available. First of all, when you start out, you are a bit conceited. You think, yeah, I'm a Buddhist monk because I understand what life is really about and I choose the best, yeah? And this is kind of the ego, which is kind of things. But I, You know, ultimately, yeah, and this is what I came to after thinking about some of the experiences I've had in life and those things. And I think that I have been a Buddhist monk in a past life. And because some of the ideas that I've had as when I was a child, things like kind of weird ideas, yeah, ideas about living in the forest by myself and all kind of things. And there are many, quite a number of things like that in my life, which kind of point me in some direction that I probably was a Buddhist monk, maybe a Buddhist nun in a past life. And one of the things, I guess we're getting a bit away here from the sutta, but one of the things that this opened for me, which was very fascinating, well, if I was a Buddhist monk in a past life, where or a nun, where would I have been? Where would that have been? Well, probably wouldn't have been anywhere in Europe. Probably would have been in Asia, yeah, Sri Lanka, Thailand, yeah, China. I have no idea. You know, somewhere in that sphere. And suddenly, you see yourself maybe as a Chinese nun, yeah, or a Sri Lankan monk or something, yeah. And you realize that that probably was your identity in a past life. And there's something very powerful about that, because you start to realize that actually this, the form that your body happens to have now in this life, is kind of random, right? And the moment you identify as a Chinese nun, you break away so many of the barriers that exist between people. And that is such a powerful thing. You start to see people, even though they may look slightly different from you, they may have a culture that is different from you, you start to look at them and you see yourself in that person. And at that moment, you start to have compassion, understanding for all people around. You understand the kind of commonality of the human experience. And so for me, that is actually this idea of rebirth. First of all, it is, you know, there is no Buddhism without rebirth, as far as I'm concerned. But the whole idea, it breaks down some of the barriers that we have in our societies, and it makes this commonality of us as human beings across genders, across cultures, across, you know, all of these things that separate us, and it makes human beings into human beings. And that's very, I think, a very useful reflection in a sense. And this is some of the reflection that came to me out of this way of looking at the world. So, yeah. Okay, thank you. So let's carry on. And there will also be an extended Q&A session at the end of the day, and I'm very happy to discuss some of these more general issues at that time. So Venerable Ananda is saying that he was consoled by the thought that the Buddha won't become fully extinguished without making some statement regarding the Sangha of mendicants. And then the Buddha replies, "But what could the mendicant Sangha expect from me, Ananda? I have taught the Dhamma without making any distinction between the secret and public teachings. The realized one doesn't have a closed fist of a teacher when it comes to the teachings. If there's anyone who thinks I will take charge of the Sangha of mendicants, or the Sangha of mendicants is meant for me, let them make a statement regarding the Sangha. But the realized one doesn't think like this. So why should he make a statement regarding the Sangha?" This is so full of really interesting things, this last sutta. Yeah? This is packed with kind of interesting stuff. And a lot of this has a lot of relevance for how we practice Buddhism in the present day. Yeah, the idea here, he starts off by saying that he has made no distinction between the secret and the public teachings. In other words, I have already told you everything. There's nothing more to say, right? Everything is out there. Everything has kind of been expressed by me. I don't have this idea that there are some people who kind of get the secret teaching, and then there's kind of the inner core and the outer core and these kind of things. And this is very common in spiritual circles, right? That there are different kind of levels, that kind of the core disciples who get the kind of inner teaching, then the kind of the intermediate group, and then the outer group are kind of just get the superficial stuff. And that, of course, is how you create cults. Yeah, you create cults by having close disciples and more kind of further away disciples. But Buddhism, everything is available for everyone. Yeah, it is out there. The Buddha has taught it. It's already part of the teachings in the world, and that to me is a very it's kind of a very positive thing about this Buddhist teachings, that you don't have this kind of secrecy about things. Everything is available. This does not mean that all the teachings are going to be as meaningful for everyone. The Buddhist teaching is very profound. Yeah, it is about non-self. It is about some of the most profound things that is possible to experience as human beings. So there is a right time to learn about things. There is a right time, certain things, just to set them aside because you can't grasp them. But it's not secret. It's just that, okay, so I'll take this on board for now and I'll think about this later. So it is available, but there's also kind of a, you know, focus on different things at different times, because as the path unfolds, your interest in what is Buddha taught is going to change as a consequence. There's nothing secret. There's no inner and outer. He doesn't have a teacher's fist when it comes to the teachings. In other words, he doesn't hold anything back. It is all out there. It is all available to the world. And then he says, if anyone thinks I will take charge of the Sangha mendicants, let them do it. Do it. I think the point, of course, is that no one is supposed to think like that, right? That's kind of the point. because the Buddha, says, but the realized one, in other words, the Buddha himself, he doesn't think like this. So why should he make some statement regarding the Sangha? That's kind of fascinating. The Buddha doesn't think, I am in charge of the Sangha. The Sangha is meant for me. Yeah, the Buddha doesn't think I'm in charge. Isn't that kind of fascinating? Because the idea of being in charge, or being the boss, or being the leader, or whatever, it takes a kind of a sense of self, right? It takes kind of a me, a feeling that I am in charge. But actually, the Buddha doesn't really have that kind of relationship to, he doesn't have the sense of I anymore. So the Buddha just teaches these things out of compassion. Okay, so here you are. These are the teachings out of compassion. And if there is a problem in the Sangha, he will help to resolve it. But there isn't that feeling of some entity, me, that is in charge and having this idea of hierarchy or whatever. There's no hierarchy in the early Sangha. Kind of, but not real, not from a personal perspective. And this then makes itself felt in how the Buddha lays down all the regulations for how the monastic Sangha is to operate. The monastic Sangha is a flat structure. Yeah, the monastic Sangha, there's no hierarchy. And you may be very surprised to hear this, because if you look at the world of monasticism everywhere in the world, it is actually very hierarchical. Yeah, it's like you have the Sangha Raja. Sangha Raja means the king of the Sangha, quite literally, at the top. And then you have like the pyramid, like the Catholic Church, yeah, ding, 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 going down, and then everyone on the bottom. But actually, the early suttas, that hierarchy doesn't exist. The structure is flat. It's a democratic structure. There are no leaders. The monasteries didn't even have abbots. There were no abbots. It was just like a flat structure. Everyone came to agreement through a democratic decision-making. And so that is how everything was in those early days. And weirdly, we have kind of gone a long way away from that in modern Buddhism. Because I think there's something in human beings, we like hierarchies. There's something inside of us that tends to form hierarchies. So even though the Buddha says we shouldn't do it, still it seems to be kind of our default mode or something. Not sure why, but that seems to be how we work. Maybe kind of to do with power or whatever, or also the fact that Buddhism moved to very hierarchical societies. And some of the East Asian societies are very hierarchical. And so that hierarchy would then make its way and influence the Sangha as well. It's important to realize that is not the way the Buddha thought about these things. The Buddha had, these were democratic structures. They were decentralized. Every monastery was responsible for itself. And other monasteries were not actually able to have an influence on individual monasteries. And this is kind of fascinating. Especially if you are a monastic, it's very interesting because it means that, well, maybe now that Buddhism is getting established in countries like the United States and Australia, which is where I live, maybe we should kind of try to move a little bit go a bit back to this early ideal again, the other way it was done by the Buddha. And I think there's a lot to be said for that, because hierarchies are problematic. Hierarchies are about power. Hierarchies are places where people get corrupted. Because what you want to do, you want to climb the hierarchy instead of living in a good way and doing the right thing. Yeah. So this is often very problematic. You see that in some of these hierarchies I see in some of the Asian countries. All the monks want to be on top of the hierarchy. That's not the point of Buddhism, to be on top of the hierarchy, right? It's to be peaceful and kind and to live well. That's the purpose of these teachings. So it tends to take away from the purpose of the path. So no hierarchy, says the Buddha. Later on, it may not be obvious here, he who just says, let anyone who thinks take charge of the Sangha, but later on he says that, well, no one, after I pass away, only the Dhamma and the Vinaya, the teachings I have given you, that is going to be your leader after I pass away here. And then the Buddha says, I'm now old, elderly, a senior, I'm advanced in years and have reached the final stage of life. I'm currently 80 years old. Just as a decrepit cart keeps going by relying on straps, in the same way, the realized one, the Buddha, in other words, body, keeps going by relying on straps, as it were. Sometimes the realized one, not focusing on any signs and with the cessation of certain feelings, enters and remains in the signless samadhi of the heart, or immersion of the heart. Only then does the realized one's body become more comfortable. So kind of pains are always there. Yeah, you know what it's like, some, those of you who are getting a bit older, you know what it's like, you know, the body gets older, pains are always kind of not so far away. That's the way it goes. And the Buddha is exactly the same. So sometimes you have to enter these deep states of samadhi, deep meditations, where the body kind of disappears. And only then are you able to let go of those kind of feelings of the body. Otherwise, they're always kind of around you. And this is one of those great things about the deep samadhi. It's possible to for the body to disappear altogether. And you start to see what nuisance this body actually is when we get into deep meditation. Very often we don't really realize. We're with the body all the time. We don't understand how problematic it is. But when the body is gone, it's like, wow, this is cool. This is really good. And we don't understand the world. This is such a big problem. This is what delusion is all about. We don't really understand suffering probably. Properly here. We don't understand the body, the downsides of the body, and all of these kind of things. And it's only as we start to approach the spiritual path and we start to let go of some of these external things that we start to understand an alternative way of viewing the world. And this is what a very large part of what meditation practice is about. Changing our outlook, seeing things in a new way, seeing the possibility of abandoning the senses and the body, letting go of all of these sufferings, and a new reality starts to emerge for you. And this is one of the exciting things about the spiritual path. The spiritual path is the most exciting thing anyone can do in this world, because it slowly changes your reality. It slowly starts to make clear where real happiness is to be found in this life. It slowly emerges what the meaning of life itself really is about. It's extraordinarily exciting and interesting. This is the spiritual path. Everything else in the world pales in comparison. This is, in a sense, what the Buddha knows here. He enters this signless samadhi. The signless samadhi, animitta samadhi, is just a deep meditation. You don't have to go into too much detail what it actually means, but it's a bit like the jhanas and these kind of things, where the world, our ordinary world, disappears and you enter a different reality here. And that's really what it is referring to here. So the Buddha, again, you see kind of the humanity of the Buddha there, the body falling apart. And then comes this beautiful little paragraph here. And this is the Buddha reminding Venerable Ananda of that you should never take your refuge in the world. Because taking refuge in the world, you're always going to be let down if you do that. One way of taking refuge in the world is to take refuge in the physical Buddha, the Buddha's presence. Because the Buddha as a body, as a human being, is impermanent and unreliable, just in the same way as the world is. So by taking that kind of refuge in the Buddha, you're taking refuge in the world. So this is a very powerful and important paragraph that we come to hear now, and it's very useful to remember this simple teaching. So Ananda, be your own island, your own refuge, with no other refuge. Let the teaching be your island and your refuge, with no other refuge. And how does a mendicant do this? It's when a mendicant meditates, observing an aspect of the body, keen, aware, and mindful, rid of desire and aversion for the world. They meditate observing an aspect of feelings, an aspect of the mind, an aspect of principles. This is Dhamma. Keen, aware, and mindful, rid of desire and aversion for the world. That is how a mendicant is their own island, their own refuge with no other refuge. That is how the teaching is the island and the refuge with no other refuge. So this is kind of one of these fundamental ideas of Buddhism. And this is the idea that the world outside of us, the world that we have in common, the world of politics, the world of wars, the world of climate change, the world of all of these problems that we see around us, that world is ultimately out of control. That world, we don't know where it's going to go. Very often it goes against where we would like it to go, right? It's only part of the population that is happy when someone gets voted. All of those people who voted against that particular person, they're going to be unhappy. This is how democracy works. It leads to always someone is going to be unhappy. These big changes in the world that we don't seem to be able to deal with, like climate change. We don't seem to have the wits to be able to deal with these things. They're just too complex. We are just small human beings. Sometimes we think that our leaders should be able to deal with the problems of the world. But are we being realistic when we think like that? Would we be able to deal with these things? Our leaders are, in the end, they are a bit like us, right? They don't really understand the whole pictures. They have their own delusions, their own misunderstandings of reality. And maybe we're just asking too much of our leaders sometimes. And sometimes we need to realize that the world is so complex, there's so many things going on, that actually it is really ultimately out of control. And so the idea here is not to say that we shouldn't care. Of course we should care. We should care, we should do our very best to help out, to do the right things, to get the world going in the right way. That is not the point, because that is just being moral. It's being moral to do the right thing in the world. But the point rather is that even if we do our very best, there is no guarantee it will go in the right direction, because it is so complex. We are only one person among 8 billion or whatever it is now, always going up and up and up. And one person among 8 billion only have a tiny amount of power. Maybe we can reach a few people around us. We can maybe kind of be kind to the people who are nearest to us or whatever. But our ability to affect anything in the world is going to be smaller. And so realizing this, understanding the impermanence of things, understanding this is true in the world writ large, but is also true in our personal world. How impermanent and unreliable everything is. Our family members, our friends, our teacher, the Buddha himself, for goodness sake, right? Everything is so uncertain. Our own life, ultimately, is so uncertain. And all of this is really in the world outside. And the more we see that, the more we withdraw our interest in something that is inherently out of control, inherently unreliable. And because it is inherently out of control and unreliable, it is also inherently suffering. It will always give rise to suffering. The moment you take your stand, the moment you attach to that, the moment you feel that the outcome of this election is crucial, at that moment you're setting yourself up for suffering because it may not go the way you want it to go. So then you withdraw your interest from that a little bit. You still do the right thing, but you don't take it so seriously anymore. And then you understand that really the one place where I have an ability to make a difference is in my own inner world. That is where each one of us has an ability to do something. It is hard enough to do something with your own inner world, because even there we are conditioned. Even there we have a past. Even there it is not easy. But at least there, it is much less likely that the world outside will really kind of push you around and make things difficult for you. So this is where we take our refuge. And this is where he here is saying, taking the Dhamma as a refuge, taking yourself as a refuge. Taking the Dhamma as a refuge here means practicing meditation. What you see here is the four satipatthanas. Yeah, that's what actually is mentioned here, the four mindfulness meditations. One of the critical teachings of the Buddha. And of course, mindfulness meditation is going inwards. It's letting go of the world outside. And it's finding meaning within instead. And building up spiritual qualities within. And it's kind of nice when you really close your eyes and you go within and the world outside fades and you can find joy within, peace within. You actually do have a refuge because you have a place where you can go at any time you want and experience meaningful things, things that alleviate all those problems and things in the outer world. That is what we mean by a refuge. And then you build that refuge up. And this is what kind of the spiritual path is about. You build that refuge up and up and up. Yeah, make it more and more powerful so as to ultimately give a kind of ultimate happiness, ultimate refuge. We're completely gone and left the whole world behind. And then the kind of weird thing is at the moment you have left the whole world behind, that is also when you have the most ability to care for that world, to give compassion for that world and do something positive. It's weird, right? It's by giving the world up, in other words, by giving up attachment and desire for it, that you have the most ability to do something good in return. So this is what the Buddha is saying here about finding a real refuge. And here, of course, it's like the Buddha's passing away symbolizes this whole idea of the world being out of control. Yeah, it symbolizes this whole mess that we are in. The Buddha says, okay, go within yourself instead. So here we have, I just mentioned here that this is about the four satipatthanas. Yes, this is about meditation practice. This is the way you really go within, finding a refuge. And this here is the standard formula you find for the satipatthanas everywhere in the suttas. Observing an aspect of the body. Keen, aware, and mindful, rid of desire and aversion for the world. What is that world? Well, that is the world of the five senses. Yeah, that is the world outside that we're talking about there. And you don't really, so you get rid of your interest in that world, and that is where the inner world starts to emerge instead. I'm not going to talk too much about this now. We can probably talk about these things in more detail later on. It's a very interesting particular formula you see there, you see it again and again in the suttas, but maybe at this particular point it's not the right time to look at that. Just trying to kind of see how much time we have. I'm not super organized. I don't kind of have exactly how much I'm going to say in each session. I don't work like that. So it's a little bit more random than that. I think fortunately, I don't like to be too organized because it becomes too kind of, just the way I am, I suppose. So I hope that makes sense to you. I'm very happy to talk more about this later on because I think this is a very important part. So this is how the teaching is your refuge and how you are a refuge for yourself. The teaching, of course, being the Dhamma. The Dhamma is what points you towards this kind of meditation experience. And then you find that refuge there. So then we make a little bit of a jump in the text. Here the Buddha is continuing and talking more about the same kind of problem that we have been talking about just now. So again, it's the monks or Rebel Ananda complaining about the Buddha passing away. You're being worried about that or concerned about that. And now the Buddha has a slightly different approach, but basically it is the same kind of thing. And the Buddha says, did I not prepare you for this when I explained that we must be parted and separated from all that we hold dear and beloved? How could it possibly be that what is born, created, conditioned, and liable to fall apart should not fall apart? The realized one has discarded, eliminated, released, given up, relinquished, and surrendered the life force. He has definitely stated the final extinguishment of the realized one will be soon. 3 months from now, the realized one will finally be extinguished. It is not possible for the realized one, for the sake of life, to take back the life force once it has been given up like this. So, again, one of these teachings that we see often in the suttas, and this is one of the teachings the Buddha says we should contemplate again and again, yeah? And this is this idea that you must be parted and separated from everything you hold dear and beloved. Like many of the Buddha's teachings, very direct. It's very in your face. Yeah, the Buddha doesn't kind of beat around the bush. He says it as it is. Okay, everything that's dear and beloved, you must be separated and parted from that. This is one of the contemplations that we should do all the time. It is a reminder that everything in our life is impermanent. Everything is completely unreliable. And initially, it is very hard to take these things. Often people don't want to hear this. You don't want to hear that all the people I love in this world are going to have to go. That is painful for most people in this world. But on the other hand, if you close your eyes to reality and you don't deal with it, it's going to be even worse, right? If we can learn to deal with this, and we can learn to build up some kind of resilience within so we can actually deal with these things, then, of course, we are heading in the right direction. And that is what the Buddha says. There is that resilience. It's possible to build up. That when things do get difficult, they get less difficult than they otherwise would. And that is the purpose of these kind of reflections. It's not to make you depressed and sad, yeah? And so you say, after coming here to the BCBS, you never come back again because it's just too depressing to be here. And that would be terrible if that happened. But no, that is not the point. The point is that this is the starting point, the beginning of understanding life as it actually is. Remember, the purpose of these teachings is to actually be realistic. And if we are not realistic, it means that we don't have a right view. Then there is no way we're going to be able to make good choices. This is why right view is at the beginning of the spiritual path, because it helps us to make good choices in life. So everything we own must be separated and parted from us. And once you get that, you start to change the way you think about your life. Why should you invest enormous amounts of time and energy into having a marvelous career, having lots of material well-being, if you know that soon enough down the track it's all going to have to go anywhere here? It's all going to be separated from you. It changes what is important in your life. Instead of making what you have in life all of these kind important, it becomes much more important how you live your life. Because the how you live your life, the quality of your heart, how you deal with other people, whether you are compassionate and kind, that is the one thing that you will take with you, that you will not be separated from when you pass away. This is where this whole idea of rebirth, or the whole idea of carrying on after we die, actually becomes so important. Because what it means is that it expands your investment horizon. Isn't that what these kind of banks talk about? Expanding, kind of extending your investment horizon. Not 5 years, 20 years. Think long term, right? The Buddha is your kind of ultimate investment kind of analyst. If you want to hear about investment, come to the Buddha. The Buddha is the master of investment. Don't think 20 years. Don't think 30 years. Think multiple lifetimes. That's why the Buddha is so interesting. So when we invest in this particular way, this is why the idea of many lives is so important, because you start to think in this really macroscopic point of view, how things actually carry on for the long term. And then you start to realize, why would I want to live a life now that is going to make me feel miserable in my next life? It doesn't make any sense, right? It's a bit like, okay, today I'm going to indulge crazily. I know that tomorrow is going to make me miserable. I don't care about tomorrow. Of course we care about tomorrow. There's no way you're going to kind of do crazy things today so that tomorrow is miserable. Actually, sometimes we do that. Like when we get really drunk and tomorrow you feel terrible. But But you know what I mean, right? You're not going to go around murdering people today and have lots of remorse tomorrow because you killed lots of people. We do care about how we feel tomorrow. And in exactly the same thing with future lives. Of course, we should take into account our future lives. And so your investment horizon expands. And you know, so what we get in this life is not that important. We have it good enough already. How we get things, how we live life, how we treat other people. Do we do things out of a sense of compassion and care and kindness? Or do we do things not caring about how we live, but what we get is what matters? It's a different approach to how we live our lives. And this is really the kind of conclusions you draw when you think like this, when you have the right view, the right intention, the right aim, the right purpose, the right goal comes into view, and you look at things in a new way. Samaditti leads to samma sankappa. Right view leads to right purpose. Right intention, if you like, but I like the idea of right purpose. You get a new purpose. You're looking at the world in a new way. You're thinking about your life in a new way. It is how I live is far more important than what I acquire during this life. I know it's one of those really awful things is when someone dies and they cannot die in peace. Yeah, they are really restless and they can't let go of this world. And then you look at their life and you realize, well, they haven't lived all that well. Yeah, they have kind of lived for this world. They have lived to acquire as much as possible they can in this life. And because they have lived for that, they haven't really cared so much about how they lived. Yeah, they were willing to kind of not really worry so much about morality, worry too much about, you know, doing the right thing. It was so important for them to acquire things in this world that they were willing to be immoral in the pursuit of those things. And then you come to the end of your life and you realize that all of these things that you acquired in the wrong way, now you have to give them up. And all you have left is that feeling of remorse and regret in your heart. That is what you carry into the future. It's terrible, right? It really is terrible. And that is why you can't let go, because you feel, I've wasted my life. I made a massive mistake. Yeah, I focused on all the wrong things. I focused on this life when actually all of that has to be given up. And now all I take with me is the feeling of badness because I lived a bad existence. Don't go there. Don't do that, because it's just terrible. I had a conversation not so fairly recently with one of the ladies that were staying with us at Bodhinyana Monastery, very impressive lady. Sometimes you meet lay people, think, wow, these lay people are more monastic than the monastics. And she's kind of one of those, right? She was like, I don't know how she does it. She lives in this by herself and she just meditates all the time and just complete seclusion, basically. And it's just astonishing. And she said, she told me she had this kind of near-death experience where she thought she was going to die. She had some very kind of powerful... was it asthmatic attack, or maybe it was some kind of seizure or something like that, and she fell out of her bed or something and she wasn't able to move, she wasn't able to breathe, she wasn't able to do anything, and she thought, I'm going to die. And then as she was thinking she was going to die, she realized, actually, there's a few things I regret in my life. I mean, she's like really good person, right? Still, we all do a few things that we regret. That's kind of part of human existence. And so she actually, there's a few things I regret. I haven't kind of dealt with that yet. I need to deal with that first. And so she then realized, I'm not ready to die because I have these regrets. She felt, how can I die with regret? Right? That's kind of the feeling she had. And so then she kind of gradually was able to draw her breath again, very, very slowly initially, very gently, very carefully. And after about half an hour of struggling to draw her breath, she was able to kind of come back again and come back to and live on as a consequence. But that was her feeling. I cannot die with a regret because it's painful to die with regrets, even though she was a very good person. And for her, that near-death experience that she had, it meant that after that, this idea of living well became even more powerfully lodged in her heart and her mind. Yeah. And really, after that, she said she wasn't really able to do anything bad anymore because it was always at the back of your mind, living well, doing the right thing, not even thinking bad thoughts, were always there, so powerfully present, because she had seen the problem that arises on your deathbed if you don't do the right thing here. And you, and so this is kind of one example of that. I will give you some more examples later on, because to me, some of these lived experiences are some of the most interesting examples. Yeah, when people actually see these things for themselves. But let's have another short break. A bit more meditation, and a bit more of a stretching, if you like to do that or whatever, and then we'll carry on afterwards. Okay. So let us carry on. So does anyone want to ask any questions about this? Or yes, please, sir. Yeah.
I've been trying to figure out how to reconcile that with the Sutta where he talks about, you know, here's this handful of leaves. Mm. And mm. How do you speak to that?
Sure, of course, yeah. I think the point of the Sutta of the handful of leaves is that the Buddha has a very broad kind of insight into the nature of the world, right? And has a lot of understanding that maybe came with the awakening experience or came with additional experience or whatever. But it's only part of that that is relevant to the spiritual path. So the Buddha, instead of diverging into all kind of things that are not really relevant to spiritual practice, which may take away your focus on what really matters, he just teaches you what you need to know so as to practice the spiritual path. And I know with myself how easily distracted I get, and something sounds interesting or whatever, and you kind of, oh, that's really interesting, But a lot of these things are philosophical points and philosophical issues, and very often there aren't any final answers to many of these things. There's endless arguments and endless kind of discussions about things. And so I think the Buddha, to avoid that and to avoid us kind of getting distracted all the time, he just gets down to the focus on the essential things. And that is, I think, what that is about. So when he says that there is no teacher's fit, he's talking about those handful of leaves. He's talking about there's no, as far as the spiritual things are concerned, nothing is left out. But the rest of the stuff actually is irrelevant anyway, so don't worry about it. Yes, please. Yeah.
So in some parts, the translation is the realized one.
Right.
He's kind of third person.
Yeah.
He does speak, he does say I in a few cases.
Yeah.
And I understand that these are written down by people following his death.
Yeah.
But from all the different suttas, what can you say, at least in this short period, about how he kind of refers to himself in the language he uses when referencing kind of like, himself.
Yeah, I think he usually uses the term the realized one. This is the Tathagata, is the Pali word for that. That's how he almost always refers to himself. And I think, I guess if you're going to be a spiritual leader like the Buddha was, you use kind of the terminology that is used in India at that time. So how would other religions or sects, how would they talk about their teacher or talk about themselves? Yeah, and if they use certain vocabulary, the Buddha might use a similar kind of vocabulary so as not to kind of underestimate himself or whatever, but to make sure that he had a status that was equivalent to these other teachers. So one of the words that is used for the Buddha everywhere in the Sutta is Bhagava, and Bhagava means like Lord or something like that. Yeah, and that was it is used very commonly for kind of spiritual teachers in India, whether they are dodgy or not. That's kind of the word they use for them. And in the same way, the word Tathagata was a word in common parlance at the time used in India for someone who was considered to be realized, whatever that meant. Different religion would mean different kind of things. So the Buddha would have taken that on board to kind of, I guess, put himself on the same level with all other teachers, so as kind of, you had a kind of level playing field or whatever or something like that. But you're right, he does sometimes use the word I in the suttas. I guess, why not? Yeah. It's kind of straight to the point. I guess, why does he use different terminology? Sometimes not. I have never really considered that question before. But I guess context, whatever might be the reason. Yeah, not entirely sure, actually, to be honest with you. Yeah. Yes, at the back there.
I'm curious
thoughts about that.
What do you mean by where are you? Oh, you mean everything is conditioned, fall apart? You mean that part of it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think the idea here is just that impermanence and these things, it gets its meaning more powerfully in the context of rebirth, right? Because the fact that things are impermanent means, I mean, let's say that you have only one life, and then when you die, everything kind of comes to a stop. Then it makes more sense, yeah. Because very often in one life you are able to hold on to things, at least some things. Not everything will disappear. You have a house. If you're lucky, it won't burn down or whatever, right? So it is this idea of impermanence gains far more power in the context of rebirth. Because when you die, that is probably the most powerful moment of impermanence that we have, right? I mean, so almost everything has to go. And the Buddha specifically says that the only thing that really remains when you die is your karma. You are the owner of a karma, is one of the kind of standard phrases in the suttas. And the owner here means that, well, it doesn't mean ultimately even that is impermanent, but at least that is far more permanent than the most things in our existence. So the idea here is that impermanence and rebirth kind of go together. And when they go together, this whole thing becomes much more powerful. That would be my answer to that. I'm not sure who was first now, so I haven't really been following properly. But please, you go first.
So here, the Buddha said that after he entered the room and remained in the immersion, in samadhi, his body become more comfortable.
Yeah.
So is it the case that he just doesn't feel the body, or the physical condition actually improved?
Yeah, it's a bit weird. It's more comfortable. What does that mean? Does that mean that he's still feeling the body? It's just that it's not as bad as it was before? That's kind of a good question. So these questions need to be answered, right? Otherwise, I'm not doing my job. So let's see. With these kind of things, there's only one choice, really. You have to go back to the Pali. Otherwise, you don't know what's going on. Fortunately, I can read Pali fairly well. So I just have to find this particular passage. Okay. Yeah, at that time the Buddha's kaya is more at ease. That's what it seems to be saying. The Buddha's kaya. So what is I don't know exactly what that means, but one of the problems with these kind of phrases is that you have to interpret the words quite precisely. And the problem is that the word kaya does not really mean physical body or body as such. It means like more the kind of sentient body. That's what kaya means. There are other words for the kind of body as a pure physical phenomenon. There's actually other words like sarira that is used in the suttas. So kaya here can just mean that the Buddha's experience is more comfortable, right? Your general experience rather than actually the physical body. So I don't know. It also depends on one's interpretation of animitta samadhi. It is possible that animitta samadhi is not as profound as a jhana state. And again, these things are very, very up for interpretation, because animitta samadhi, this particular signless meditation, is actually very badly defined in the suttas. It is defined as not paying attention to any signs or any marks. In other words, you don't pay attention to any permanent, seemingly permanent aspects of the world or things that make things what they are. You know, what makes something what it is? Well, it's because it has certain characteristics. But if everything is always changing and permanent, the characteristics kind of don't exist anymore because of continuous change. This is this idea of things are continuously changing. Nothing is really stable. So what kind of samadhi is that. And it may be that the body is still perceivable within that kind of state of samadhi, it's just that it's changing all the time. So it is hard to really come to any conclusion on that one. So I'm not really sure what it means, to be honest with you. And I always wondered myself, why doesn't he go into a jhana state? Yeah, and get kind of rid of the body completely. That would have been seem like a good idea. But that's not what it is. I don't really have a final answer on that one, unfortunately. Yeah. Okay, shall we stop there? Please, if you have a question, write it down or something. We'll take it this evening, because this evening we'll have an extended Q&A session, or bring it to the next time. So otherwise, we're going to take too much time, unfortunately. So please carry on later on. Okay, so you're parted and separated from everything dear and beloved to you. So how could it possibly be that that which is born, created, conditioned, and liable to fall apart should not fall apart? Yeah, so anything in the world which is created, has come into existence, is impermanent. If something has been created, something has arisen, it will also fall apart. It is also impermanent and will disappear later on. And what are those things that have come into existence like that? Well, pretty much everything in our experience. Yeah, can you point to anything in your experience that has not arisen somewhere, that has always been there? And the answer is, from the Buddhist point of view, no. Everything in your experience has somehow arisen and come into existence. And so there's nothing really to hold on to in this world. And that is kind of what the Buddha is saying here. And then the Buddha says that he has discarded all these things, and he has given up the life faculty, and he will not take it back once he has given it up. I guess once the Buddha gives something up, once he makes a decision, that's it. He can't kind of, he's not a flip-flopping Buddha. He goes kind of one direction only here. So, and then he says, come on, Anana, let's go to the great wood, to the hall with the peaked roof. Yes, sir, Ananda replied. So the Buddha went with Ananda to the hall with the peaked roof and said to him, go, Ananda, gather all the mendicants staying in the vicinity of Vesali together in the assembly hall. Yeah, this sounds like it's going to be some serious conversation. Yeah, get all the mendicants gathered together. I'm going to address them, right? So this is kind of exciting. That's going to come up next. Yes, sir, replied Ananda. He did what the Buddha asked, went up to him, bowed, stood to one side, and said to him, sir, the mendicant Sangha has assembled. Please, sir, go at your convenience. Then the Buddha went to the assembly hall, where he sat down at the seat spread out and addressed the mendicants. So, mendicants, having carefully memorized those things that I have taught you from my direct knowledge, you should cultivate, develop, and make much of them, so that this spiritual practice may last for a long time. That would be for the welfare and happiness of the people, for the benefit, welfare, and happiness of gods and humans. And what are those things that I have taught from my direct knowledge? They are the four kinds of mindfulness meditation, the four right efforts, the four bases of psychic power, the five faculties, the five powers, the seven awakening factors, and the Noble Eightfold Path. So this is interesting, right? This is a kind of, I think, one of these very critical things that the Buddha says in this particular sutta, because here he is giving guidance to what his teachings really are, what they are about. And of course, the first thing he talks about is having carefully memorized those things, right? You will notice here that he says, I have taught from my direct knowledge. And so all of these things that the Buddha teaches is always from direct knowledge. The Buddha doesn't take things on board simply because they are part of the culture. Simply because things are accepted in Indian culture doesn't mean the Buddha says, yeah, I guess I'll accept that. Maybe except for ordinary customs, yeah, that's fine. But not in terms of philosophy or these kind of things. He will always check them out. And either he will realize them or he will reject them if they cannot be realized. This is a very important point. It's a very important point when it comes to things like rebirth. Because very often we find that people in the Western world, they will reject ideas such as rebirth because they consider it like a philosophical, a metaphysical position. They consider it something that has been accepted as a cultural aspect of Indian culture. But the Buddha doesn't work like that. He doesn't take things on board simply because they're part of the culture. In fact, the idea that life comes to an end when you die and there is like this materialist outlook of the world, it already existed at the time of the Buddha. So this was already have been considered by the Buddha. He only teaches things if they are realizable. And so I tend to turn the table on these people who call themselves secular Buddhists. Is any secular Buddhist here, by the way? I should always ask because... But it doesn't matter. Of course, you're very welcome to be here if you're a secular Buddhist. Because a secular Buddhist, how it is often defined these days, is this defined in the sense of rejecting things like rebirth, right? And they say that, well, it is the idea of rebirth is like a metaphysical idea, it's a philosophical or a speculative position that we take. But actually, I would say the opposite. It is the rejection of rebirth, which is a speculative idea. Because from a Buddhist point of view, the idea of rebirth has been realized by the Buddha, and it is potentially realizable by any one of us. We don't know that, so we take it on board as confidence from the Buddha. We don't say that we know these things, but because the Buddha says so, we take it seriously. But that is not a metaphysical position. It comes from, first of all, being realized and then being taught. It's just like having a teacher at school. The teacher says certain things about the world and you take it on confidence from the teacher. This is a similar kind of thing. But if you reject the idea of rebirth out of hand, well, that certainly is a metaphysical position because you don't know that there is no rebirth and you may not have much confidence, you may not have any good reasons for thinking so either. It's just part of our culture, part of our heritage, that how we think about things. So this idea that when the Buddha speaks, he speaks from realization is very significant because it means that when you read the word of the Buddha, you should take it seriously. Yeah, this is what confidence in the Buddha means. This is what it means to be a Buddhist. If you take refuge in the Buddha, you can't reject what he says because if you reject what he says, you are saying, actually, I don't think he was enlightened or he didn't have any real insight. That's what you're really saying at that point. That is counter to the idea of being a Buddhist. So this actually is very significant. So this is what we should memorize, yeah, says the Buddha. This, of course, speaking here to the monastic community, and this is this idea that in those days the whole tradition was passed on orally. It was an oral tradition. It was passed on from one generation of monastics to the next generation of monastics orally, yeah, so you should memorize it carefully. And this is this idea that if you do memorize things carefully, it is surprising that you're actually able to pass on even oral teachings very faithfully from one generation to another one. You will hear people often saying, but this is orally transmitted. How can we take this seriously? Surely lots of kind of, problems have gone into oral transmission because, you can't remember what did he say again? Oh, maybe he said this. Yeah, let's put that in there. But actually, it doesn't work like that. It turns out that oral transmission actually turns out to be a very powerful way of transmitting things. And one of the reasons for that is because there was a pre-existing oral culture in India that had existed already for thousands of years, that was part of the Brahmanical tradition. And so there was like a system, like a technology, if you like, of oral transmission that the Buddhists could use, that they gathered from the existing Vedas. And so they were able to transmit these teachings extremely faithfully for hundreds of years after the Buddha passed away, using the same technology. It is very well known that these Vedic methods of transmitting these Hindu or Brahmanical scriptures, it is known that they were able to transmit text almost verbatim for hundreds and hundreds of years because of the techniques they used for transmitting these things. And we have good reasons to think that the Buddhists did the same. Yeah, because we have, I'm not going to get into that now, but there is ways by analyzing these texts that you can know that also the Buddhist texts were faithfully preserved for over very, very long periods of time in this way. So from the very beginning, there was this idea of being conservative about these texts. These are very important texts. We need to conserve them the way they are. We're not going to be radical and kind of add all new stuff into them. We should conserve them the way they are. And so for that reason, it seems that that is exactly what happened in the history of Buddhism. We can talk more about this later on if you're interested in this, but it's actually quite a fascinating area of discussion here. And then comes the other part, which is fascinating here, yeah? You should cultivate, develop, and make much of these teachings so that this spiritual practice may last for a long time. And this is the idea, of course, that the real understanding of the content of the text comes from practicing them, from having similar kind of realizations. Yeah? And it's very dangerous to become too much just of a linguist and a scholar of the texts. It is through an understanding, through your own experience, that these things really come alive. And as long as we don't have those experiences, we're going to be arguing about the content of these texts. What do they actually mean? Yeah? What are they? What does it mean to go into deep state of samadhi? What is that? What is that experience like? And so that is through experience that these things are kept alive. And there's something about people who have experienced these things, they will often have a natural kind of authority about them. And the reason is because they exude those qualities that you expect someone who practices these teachings to have. Yeah. So our job is to look carefully. And when you see someone with special qualities, you know that this is where you should place some confidence. But you have to be wise about that, because this can be quite a tricky area as well. Everything is tricky, unfortunately. So sometimes you just have to, you know, you have to be, just do your best, basically. Yeah, and then when that happens, and these teachings get passed on in the right way, it is for the welfare and happiness of the people, yeah, the people of the world, for the benefit, welfare, and happiness of gods and humans. This is what the Dhamma is about. It is only for the happiness and benefit of everyone. This is the purpose of these teachings. No other purpose. That's why we want to keep them alive. We want to keep on practicing teaching these things. That's why we are here right now. And then comes the kind of final part. So what are those teachings that he has taught in this way? And then comes this idea, so the four mindfulness meditations, the four right efforts, the four basic psychic powers, the five faculties, the five powers, the seven awakening factors, and the Noble Eightfold Path. And these, as a group, are called the 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas, 37 aids to awakening. And this is like a standard group that you find in the suttas in many places. And if you look at those 37 qualities, you will see that they are very practical things. Yeah, they're all about what we have to do, how we have to practice, and what this path is about. There is no speculation there. There is no philosophy. There's no extraneous material that is irrelevant to the path. It gets down to very practical things. It is not entirely practical, because there is also the philosophical framework for those that practice. Yeah, it is not just enough just to have a practice. We need to have a framework for the practice. We need to know why we are practicing. And that framework is found here in the Noble Eightfold Path, which starts with the right view. Right view being the understanding of the Four Noble Truths. Yeah, so there is a little bit of framework to make sense of why we're practicing the path. But it's a minimal of framework. The vast majority of the practice is about what it is that we have to do. So that is what the path is about, yeah? Really practical things. And when you start to read the suttas, you start to see that actually most of it is about practical things. How we should think, how we should reflect, how we should learn to perceive, how we should think about our fellow human beings, what it means to speak in the kind way, what it means to act in the bad way, how to watch the breath in the right way. All of these kind of things is what the suttas are about. Very practical, down-to-earth stuff. And that is very useful to know, because what it means is that straight away it becomes clear a number of things that are not really important. Yeah, and one of those things that I would consider not important would be things like the Abhidhamma. Abhidhamma is sometimes called like the higher teachings. But if you read the Abhidhamma as the Abhidhamma Pitaka, it is extraordinarily dry. Yeah, and I don't know how anyone can read it without falling asleep, to be honest. Depends. If you get it presented by someone who is really knowledgeable, they can present it in an interesting way. But if you just read the actual Tipitaka itself in the Abhidhamma, actually it is extraordinarily dry. And it sounds like just this enumeration of kind of different mind states, enumeration of different states of matter, how they relate to each other and these kind of things. And it's sometimes very hard to know how to use these things practically. So, yeah, straight away get a feeling, maybe this is not kind of core. Then you have things like the Jataka stories. You heard about the Jataka stories, yeah? And often very beautiful stories, right? And very interesting in some ways, but also a little bit too much on the story side, right? Okay, interesting, there is a little bit of Dhamma there, but it's not really practical in the way the suttas are. And I'm not saying you should become a sutta fanatic, just read suttas. Please read some of the other stuff as well, because it can be nice. I'm just saying, remember what the core is. Remember what the essence are of these teachings. So this is already a very good guideline where to find the essence of the teachings of the Buddha. Now, if you analyze these 37 aids to awakening, and you put them, you tabulate them, this is the kind of thing I do on my spare time, yeah, tabulate the 37 factors of awakening, yeah. And then you kind of, actually, maybe I should, I have this, I haven't used the projector yet. Okay, there's no need for this, I can just talk about this. But, so, and if you tabulate them, then what you see is that there are certain elements that recur in this 37. And the three elements, how do I get three out of these fingers? Three elements that recur in this 37 is the idea of effort, yeah, right effort if you like, or energy. The second one is the idea of mindfulness, and the third one is the idea of samadhi or deep meditation. Yeah, and if you look at those 37, something like 24 out of those 37 are about that. Yeah, 24 out of 37, well, that's the majority, are about three factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. And of course, those three factors, if you look at them, what are they about? Well, they are about the cultivation of mind, right? Right effort is about cultivating right thought, how to look at things, how to reflect about the world. Right mindfulness is about meditation practice itself, how to watch the breath, these kind of things. And right samadhi at the very end is about the deep states of meditation that we are aiming at the end of this particular path. And that gives an idea of the kind of core of Buddhism. The core of Buddhism is mental cultivation. It is not the only thing. There is also the more basic aspects of virtue and kindness, but that is really the core. And for many people, the most important part of that, again, is the idea of learning how to think, learning how to perceive in the right way. Yeah? Thinking in a way that gives rise to positive states of mind and not negative qualities. This is such an important part of the Buddha's path. And it is surprisingly easy to do. Yeah? It is not that hard to learn to think differently. It takes time. It takes commitment. It takes perseverance. But it's not hard. So these are the 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas. Don't have to remember that, because it's too hard to remember, but it is that is the Pali expression for it. So let us just finish off this sutta. These are the things I have taught from my direct knowledge. Having carefully memorized them, you should cultivate, develop, and make much of them, so that this spiritual practice may last for a long time. That would be for the welfare and happiness of the people, for the benefit, welfare, and happiness of gods and humans. I like this idea of gods and humans, right? The gods, they come to the Buddha, And they say, Buddha, please teach us. We are deluded. We don't understand. This is the Buddhist idea of gods. And kind of different from a theistic religion, where the god is kind of the supreme being. Here, the gods is the opposite. The gods come to the Buddha instead. So we can talk more about gods later on and what that means. But they are pretty much like human beings, basically. Just glorified human beings, really. Then the Buddha said to the mendicants, come now, mendicants, I say to you all, conditions fall apart, persist with diligence. The final extinguishment of the realized one will be soon. 3 months from now, the realized one will finally be extinguished. So, I don't know if you recognize that sentence, that those are the last words of the Buddha. He says it here, but he also says this on his deathbed, just as he is about to pass away. The last words of the Buddha, right? So if they are the last words of the Buddha, they must be really significant. You can imagine the Buddha is not going to kind of say anything silly on his last words, right? Conditions fall apart, vaya dhamma sankhara. Vaya dhamma literally means having the nature to come to an end. Dhamma is all things, yeah? All things have the nature of coming to an end. Vaya dhamma sankhara. And then persist with diligence. Appamadena sampadeta. Yeah? Appamadena means like with heedfulness. Not just diligence, but being heedful. Heedful is different from being diligent. Heedful means you are careful. Yeah, you consider things properly. You are circumspect. Yeah, so you are successful, or you practice with circumspection, with carefulness, with heedfulness. You look at the world. You don't make hasty decisions or conclusions, but you look at things with care. Yeah, this is the idea here. So these are the last words of the Buddha. And what you will notice if you look at those things carefully, the idea that all phenomena in the world have the nature to come to an end, to cease, to disappear. This is really the idea of right view. This is the idea of right view in one sentence. Yeah, the one thing that is at the crux of the Buddha's teachings. Everything in the world must come to an end. Nothing persists. Nothing can last. Yeah, and once you get that, once you remember this one thing, yeah, and you make that a contemplation in your life, yeah, combined with things like the idea of rebirth, that becomes like a guiding light for you as an individual, or for the whole Buddhist teachings as a whole. Everything must come to an end. This is the idea of impermanence. Yeah, everything must cease. Nothing in this world will last forever. There is nothing to hold on to. There's nowhere you can take your stand. The moment you take your stand, yeah, you can imagine standing on this carpet here, the nature comes and pulls the carpet out from under your feet. That is what nature does. And when nature pulls the carpet from under your feet, you stumble, you fall over, and you hurt yourself. Impermanence always leads to suffering. That's the nature of impermanence. Everything, nothing is reliable in this world. Turn inward, turn away from that. Appamadena sampadeta, yeah? Have success, practice on, carry on with carefulness, with heedfulness. Yeah? Don't make hasty decisions. Look carefully at everything in the world. Don't accept things on purely out of faith. Think for yourself, yeah? But also have faith. When you finally decide that the Buddha has something to say, at least take his word seriously. Don't become one of these kind of radical skeptics who doesn't believe in anything. That's also the wrong way. Find the middle way in everything that you do, and then you're going to be on the right track. So these final words of the Buddha, yeah, they kind of summarize, on the one hand, the idea of right view. And the second part, practice on with heedfulness, well, that summarizes the path of practice. The path of practice is one where we are careful and circumspect and practice on that basis. And then he says, 3 months from now, the realized one will finally be extinguished. And of course, being extinguished, that is a word for parinibbana, or nibbana if you like. And it's very common when people translate, they don't translate the word nibbana And I think that's a bad idea. We should translate the word Nibbana, because the word Nibbana actually has a meaning, and it did have a meaning for the ancient Indians. When the ancient Indians heard the word Nibbana, they will have an understanding for what it means, right? But we, when we heard Nibbana, we have no idea what it means. We know it's a band called Nirvana, but I mean, that's kind of that's a different thing. We are clueless, right? That's the highest conceit for you, calling your band Nirvana, right? That's kind of really... But because we have no idea what it means, we have no intuition about it, we tend to put our own ideas into the word. And that is why it is a bad idea to leave it untranslated. We should translate it so as to help people to understand, so that people will get a feeling for what it means in the same way as the ancient Indians had an idea of what it meant when they heard it. So extinguished is a nice word for that. I had a discussion with Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi about this some time ago, and I said to him, well, how should we translate Nibbana? And I said, maybe extinction. But he said, no, extinction is too negative. Extinguishment is the way to go. And it kind of has the idea of extinguishing a flame, yeah, which is one of the similes that or metaphors that we use for the idea of Nibbana. So we get into Nibbana already. Well, we merely started this retreat. Okay, well, anyway, we kind of get to the deepest, but that's all right. So that is all for this morning. I have to go off and get my meal because I had to finish my meal before 12, and I have a special deal with the kitchen. So I'm going to go down there now. For everyone, rest of you, please carry on for the next hour. Do whatever you feel is appropriate. Yeah, there's no fixed schedule here. If you want to meditate, you want to do some walking meditation or sitting meditation or whatever, please do so. And at 12 o'clock, I believe you have your lunch. So if someone would like to ring the bell at 12, would you like to ring the bell at 12? Huh?
I want to do some walking meditation.
You can do walking meditation, okay. All right, okay. We can come walk in here and ring the bell when you finish.
Sure.
Is that a good idea? Is that all right? I'll leave that to you. Find a responsible person you will be. I'll leave that one there for you. So great. So please keep on enjoying yourself, and then we'll see you back again at 2 p.m. So see you back again at 2.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.